argument in Burns versus State. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Santino Chakoti on behalf of the appellant, Robert Burns. There are three issues before the Court, which involves the trial court's abuse of discretion when it refused to declare a mistrial after the complainant's father, from the witness stand, made a dramatic and calculated outburst directed at Mr. Burns. Second, the trial court's violation of Burns' Sixth Amendment rights to confrontation and cross-examination when it refused to conduct the requested in-camera review of relevant statements from the complainants to their therapist. And lastly, the trial court's failure to admit copies of the complainant's recorded videotaped CAC interviews into evidence. On the very first day of trial, the state called the complainant's father to the witness stand. Prior to his testimony, he had numerous conversations, the prosecutor did, numerous conversations as to what was appropriate behavior in the courtroom. Nonetheless, within seconds of his testimony, the complainant's father let loose with a calculated diatribe that put a screeching halt to the trial. Furthermore, realizing what had just occurred, defense counsel objected, only to be told to be quiet by the trial judge. Following the outburst, the jury was ushered out of the courtroom for nearly 2 hours before any curative instruction was given. And furthermore, when the jury was summoned back in, even though the trial court had found that it was calculated, the trial court left this portion out of the curative instruction, insinuating that it might have been a natural reaction. This court reviews outbursts of this nature under the four factors in Taylor, which involve the nature of the outburst, the prejudice to the defendant, the closeness of the case, and lastly, the curative instructions adequacy. Turning to the first issue, the manner that the outburst was directed was accusatory. The manner it was delivered was direct. The record states that the complainant's father rose out of his chair, began to point to the defendant, and the outburst could be heard even outside the courtroom doors. Furthermore, the graphic nature of the outburst referenced the charges, albeit more serious ones. There were charges that the defendant was, that had been alleged against the defendant. It had the propensity to conjure in the jury's mind that these charges somehow were associated with Mr. Burns. I think what's very telling with regard to this is the jury's verdict, which was inconsistent. And
that cuts both ways, doesn't it?
It does.
It can show inconsistency, or it can show that they carefully considered the evidence fairly.
Yes, except in this case, the record indicates, if we look at the evidence that the jury considered, there was one common occurrence where both complainants alleged the assault, yet the jury chose to only believe one of the complainants. And what's even more telling about this is the fact that the older sister initiated the charges. She's the one who told or confided in three adults, her friends, and yet the jury chose to disregard her account. So although jury lenity is something that is being argued by the state, I think the record shows that it was the proverbial wild card of the outburst that likely injected any conviction at all here. If we turn to the closeness of the case, the state concedes that this case follows a close case paradigm. There was no physical evidence at all. It was strictly the statements of the complainants. With respect to the curative instruction, The decision, when the court made the decision to wait 2 hours to give any curative instruction, they were not faced with the decision to give a curative or nothing at all. They could spend time deciding whether a mistrial was warranted, but they chose to wait 2 hours to let the jury know that what had just occurred should not be considered at all. In fact, this court...
Could I interrupt you for a second? In terms of the waiting 2 hours, that may have been the amount of time that elapsed, but it's not as if the jury was sent out and was sitting in the jury room for 2 hours not knowing what's going on. They went to lunch, right?
You're exactly right.
And so doesn't that take a little bit away from the time problem, because they would be going to lunch even if there hadn't been a problem? Something comes up, the court says, okay, this is a good time for a recess, go to lunch. And then as soon as they come back, the court says, there was a problem before you left, and here's what you've got to do with that. So does that two-hour gap really have the kind of importance that it might otherwise have?
It absolutely does. And for the reason that this court stated in Dawson, that it's not belated curative instructions that are going to, correct egregious behavior like this. It's prompt ameliorative instructions. In fact, in Loper, when this court reviewed limiting instructions regarding prior convictions, it actually stated that they should be immediate. And that's why the difference, the options that the court had at the time enabled it to have a sua sponte curative instruction while it waited 2 hours to decide on the mistrial. That's exactly why the 2 hours is so significant. They should have stopped the harm, or at least attempted to mitigate it, as soon as it occurred. And that doesn't go without saying that they couldn't do their diligent research during that time period. But I think what this court has held is that it's prompt ameliorative instructions that are going to stop the harm. Even more egregious was the state's tacit endorsement of the outburst during its closing argument. The state in its closing referenced the jury back to the outburst by saying that Mr. Burns was responsible for the dramatic trauma that they witnessed. It's clear they referred to the outburst that stopped the trial. This is even after the trial court directly instructed them that they could not consider this. But the prosecutor brought them right back to it. And that's just the buttressing is what is even more harmful here. Adding to that,
the reference was people injured or harmed in this courtroom, or that you witnessed in this courtroom?
The exact words, Your Honor, which I believe is in page 143 of Appellant's Appendix, says the only person responsible for the hurt and pain and the emotional trauma that you witnessed in the courtroom is Mr. Burns. And I think it goes without saying that what the outburst was one of the most traumatic witnessed experiences in the trial.
Was that the only display of emotion in the case?
No, it was not. But I think it was the most graphic, and it was the most, I think there were two other times where witnesses had to stop for minor periods to gather their composure. But this was the cornerstone of the trauma in that trial. I mean, this stopped the trial. And I think when the prosecutor wanted to reference that, it was clear that it likely triggered in the jury's mind what they were told to disregard. It also defeats the purpose of the curative instruction.
Now, was there an objection to that argument?
There was not. But that's not what is appealed. We're appealing the actual harm to that. So the appeal is from the outburst. I think the prosecutor's comment goes to the harm with respect to what harm came from the outburst. And I think it's inappropriate to look at it in a vacuum with just the outburst when throughout the trial we have instances where the jury seems to want to go, you know, the state's trying to put them back to the outburst because it was so traumatic. With respect to the second issue, with regard to the in-camera review, the most troubling statement from the trial court in this decision is that somehow they want to place the burden on the defense to state specifically what we want to find in the materials that were sought. The problem with that is the law is clear, as the United States Supreme Court issued in Pennsylvania v. Ritchie, that it's what you might find in the relevant documents. It's not, you don't have a burden to tell the court what is going to be in the documents for the in-camera review. It's what you may find. And I think the trial court and the state adopts this position that somehow you can't speculate as to what you might find. That's exactly the reason for the in-camera review, to find out what could be in those documents.
Well, will that happen in every case where there's counseling for a victim?
Well, what happened in every case?
That there's going to be a need for in-camera review of the records of the psychologist or psychiatrist?
When it's relevant and compelling, as it was in this case, I would say yes. I think what seems to be, I guess, missed here by the state and the trial court is we're dealing with Sixth Amendment rights, which is to effective cross-examination and confrontation. These aren't rights to disregard for even the slightest possibility that there would be exculpatory evidence. This case was about strictly credibility of the complainants.
Well, are you saying that privileges are unconstitutional, if per se, or not?
No. What I'm saying is that there's a balancing test. And the balancing test endorsed by the United States Supreme Court in Pennsylvania v. Ritchie and adopted by the Superior Court's jurisprudence in this state. This court has not addressed the issue directly as to when in-camera reviews are necessary to be done, but what the Superior Court has endorsed, which is what the U.S. Supreme Court is when you're dealing with fundamental principles and rights, such as the Sixth Amendment, what harm is it to have a neutral judge do an in-camera review? We're not asking for the documents to be turned over. Not having the documents turned over is not per se unconstitutional.
Well, did the – I want to focus on what your specific contention is. Did the trial judge in this case correctly state the law and the balancing test? Or are you arguing for a different test? Or are you arguing that on the facts the judge abused her discretion?
The latter. The judge abused her discretion. And defense counsel made one of the most specific demands with respect to these statements. The defense counsel was not asking for diagnoses, for reports, the statements of the complainants to the therapist. It was narrow. It could not get more narrow than that. There was a therapy session. There were statements made. This case relied on the complainant's statements. To conduct an in-camera review, to check.
Help me connect the standards of review between your assertion of a Sixth Amendment right being compromised or violated and with the judge's exercise of discretion in not undertaking the review. Are you asking us to review this decision based on an abuse of discretion or are we reviewing this de novo as a Sixth Amendment violation?
We're asking the court, well, with respect to the federal question about the Sixth Amendment violation can be reviewed de novo by this court. The abuse of discretion standard, we feel we meet that standard as well. So if the court chooses either or, we feel that the record supports both violations. With respect to the relevancy of the information, I think it can't be stressed enough that the state's case hung on the fact that these allegations were made several years before they came to trial. Also, the complainants destroyed statements they made before trial. The record's clear about that also. So what we're left with is strictly the CAC statements and the testimony. Now, it's clear that credibility was, you know, was the crucial and critical factor of this case. So a harmless in-camera review to find out whether there was any possible exculpatory evidence or impeachment, you know, to use for impeachment, is clearly abuse of the trial court's discretion. More recently,
the rationale of the trial judge was that not enough was shown to even trigger that review. And why is that wrong?
That rationale is flawed, Your Honor, because what the trial court is engaging is also speculation. She's speculating that we won't find anything in those documents. But that's the purpose of the in-camera review. I think that's what gets lost in all of this.
But if I understand your position correctly, you would, and if this court were to adopt your position, wouldn't it become basically the law in Delaware that if there's a criminal case and there's any kind of medical records that include statements from the victim of whatever the crime is, that the trial court has to undertake an in-camera review just to see if there's anything there?
No, I don't think so.
Well, what is the standard that would be applied that would make it necessary in this case but not in some other case?
Well, to start with, Rule 17 does give us some parameters, which is the Superior Court rule to get evidence that's not in the control of the state. So if you don't meet the rules of Rule 17, then the purpose of the in-camera review, there is no purpose. The problem is when you get past that and you're dealing with the concern of confidentiality with the psychiatrist-patient privilege, it's a balancing test. If the request was too broad, there's been cases in the Superior Court, such as Wood, Red, where defense counsel was seeking all psychiatric records. That's too vague. That's too broad. We understand that. But this was narrow and specific. And with respect to relevancy, how much more relevant can we get than with the heart of the state's case or the statements of the complainants? That's what the case is about.
And you have about 3 minutes left in the time you reserved. Do you want to save that, or would you like to continue?
I'd like to save it. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the state. Excuse me one moment. The state will respond to the claim first claim first in order, unless the court would like otherwise. Regarding the father's outburst at trial, first of all, it was the second day of trial, not the first day. And it came at a point where the prosecutor was beginning to ask the father questions about the initial reporting of the molestation. And the prosecutor asked, who was giving you information at this point, trying to determine whether what the father had told police. Father replied, my only sources of information were the girls and Susan. Were you asking questions to get that information? I'm sure I was. And then he came forth with the unsolicited outburst. The jury was immediately removed. This was at 11:16 a.m. There was much discussion. The court called the jury back in, excused them for lunch, explaining there was an issue.
Before we skip over the discussion, did the court conclude or make a finding that the outburst was calculated and intentional?
The court did say it was calculated. It appeared to be calculated by the witness, and that he intended to say what he said, that clearly he was upset and wanted to say something to the defendant. Yes, the court did make that finding.
Well, and I understand the court did not attribute that to the state, but the argument on appeal seems to be because it was calculated, and that should have been part of the curative instruction.
There was no need to make that part of the curative instruction. The instruction indicated to the jury that they should not consider the outburst at all. It's not really relevant to the jury whether, clearly the jury could see that he intended to say what he said. It was not drawn out of him in any particular way. It was not elicited by anyone, and it was clearly non-responsive. There would be little point in telling the jury, well, the court finds he intended to say that. The jury could certainly see that the witness intended to say what he said. This was a father of girls who had alleged that they'd been abused by the defendant. It was not. It was a very emotional situation for. It was a family that was being torn apart on both sides. There were emotions high on all sides of this case.
As the trial continued, did the state make reference to the outburst?
No. The reference in closing was in response to the defense counsel had insinuated that the older girl had failed to protect her sister and had she became emotional on the stand. Her sister became emotional on the stand. The friend of the older girl became emotional and cried on the stand. There was a lot of emotion. There was also emotion regarding the family members, as I said, on both sides. So the prosecutor's reference to the trauma and pain and emotional trauma was to the victims. It was certainly, and to the fact that the whole family that had, there was testimony that the grandparents' relationship was now strained. There were sibling relationships that were strained. This was a difficult situation. It was not in reference to the father's outburst.
Does the record reflect any instructions given by the prosecutor prior to the trial to the father?
Yes, the record reflects that the prosecutor spoke to the witness about appropriate and inappropriate behavior in the courtroom, and that she had said that to this particular witness.
And that would have encompassed this very outburst that was made.
It was prior to this.
I understand that.
Yes.
But it was basically, don't do what he ultimately did.
Exactly.
Well, what should be the consequence of that?
Well, the consequence is that there had to be a curative instruction. There was a problem. The state, there will always be witnesses who will make non-responsive statements, and certainly the state does its best to control their witnesses, but in this case you look at the harm and see what was the harm. In this case, what he said once, it was stopped. It was clearly not something that went to something he was actually accused of doing, and this was repeated over and over and over throughout the trial, that the only allegation was that he had used his hands to touch the girls. There was never any allegation that he had used his penis to touch the girls.
What more would the father, have had to have done to justify a mistrial? If he had stood up, would that have been enough? If he had left the stand and moved in the direction of the defendant, would that have been enough?
that would, if the trial judge was there, and she could certainly determine the reaction to the courtroom of what was going on. And if, in her estimation, yes, if he had stood up and tried to attack the defendant, that could possibly have resulted in a mistrial. There's no fine line that can be drawn. This is why it is in the judge's discretion to look at this and to determine under the totality of the situation whether it was likely the jury would be misled and whether the defendant was going to suffer unfair prejudice as a result, or whether there was any possible way to avoid a mistrial and continue. And in this case, it certainly was possible, and the verdict is a reflection of that. The jury was certainly able to differentiate one between the victims and two between the different charges.
Well, defense counsel makes a point of the time lag between the incident and the curative instruction. And I understand that the parties were discussing with the court whether a mistrial was required and so on, but there was really nothing to prevent the court from giving an immediate curative instruction, then granting a recess, and still considering whether that was enough or whether a more elaborate instruction should follow when they came back from their recess or whether a mistrial was required. But in the meantime, have the court step right up so that the jury doesn't spend any period of time thinking about, gee, I wonder what that all meant.
Perhaps a better practice would have been for the trial judge to give an instruction sua sponte immediately. No request was made for one by defense at that point in time. And
the lawyer was told to be quiet.
Yes, but they did call the jury back in to give them the news that they were going to lunch and that they were going to discuss an issue. And the trial judge, in fact, was concerned that the situation would be made worse by, which is why she asked the defense counsel not to speak until the jury had been removed.
Well, how do we read our prior cases that say the curative instruction should be prompt? To the extent we said repeatedly, that's an important feature of a curative instruction. How do we reconcile it with what happened in this case? Are you arguing that 2 hours later was prompt enough, or are you suggesting that it should have been done differently in response to Justice Berger's question, but here it didn't matter because the jury verdict reflects they sorted it all out satisfactorily?
Well, I think it was sufficient given the particular facts in this case and the situation. It never certainly would not have hurt to give an immediate instruction of some description. This certainly not. That would have been fine. However, in this case, the fact that they did have a lunch break, that it was not an unusual time to take a lunch break, and that they were promptly instructed when they returned to the courtroom, the state would contend is sufficient in terms of promptness given this particular scenario. And certainly the other factors would indicate that this was not a case for a mistrial, the jury verdict does demonstrate that they were not misled, and the repeated testimony that regarding what actually the defendant was charged with certainly made it clear to the jury that what this witness had said was not relevant to the trial.
Was any instruction given to the jury before they went to lunch, such as don't discuss the case during the lunch and recess among yourselves or with anyone else, don't form or express any opinion on it?
They were given a short instruction about going to lunch. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact wording there. I can certainly look that up.
Okay, so they were there getting an instruction, and that obviously would have been an opportunity to say something.
Yes. Um, As to the second argument, the state contends that the trial court appropriately did a balancing test to determine whether or not the defense was entitled to have an in-camera review of the therapist records from the girls. The in this case, the defense was arguing that inconsistent statements that were basically inconsistencies between the two different victims was sufficient to a sufficient basis to establish that there was a likelihood of inconsistent statements in the therapist's notes. That was not, the court trial court found that was not a compelling basis to have an in-camera review. And that, in fact, was correct.
Why is the standard compelling?
Because this is a privileged communication that the defense would like to invade. And it's protected for a reason, as are other privileges. And courts have found those privileges are important. Historically, their privileges have gone back a long way, and they have been maintained. However, when you are balancing the rights of a defendant, then you must balance. There may be times when those rights are so compelling that you must invade a privilege.
We're not talking at this stage about letting defense counsel see those notes. We're talking about having the trial judge take a look. And, you know, isn't that much less of an invasion of the confidentiality? I mean, I realize people don't want anybody to see medical records and other confidential information like that. But we're talking about a criminal trial here. We're talking about very little evidence other than the statements of the two victims, and potentially information from a neutral third party that could bear upon the quality of their recollections and the quality of their what happened, the actual facts.
Well, the request by defense was only for inconsistent statements about the factual incidents in the case made by the victims to their therapist. There was no indication that they were challenging the capacity or competency of the witnesses, that there was no ongoing treatment, there was no issue about possible recantation. The only thing that the defense was looking for were inconsistencies, and the only basis they had to establish that any likelihood of those were inconsistencies about whether someone was awake, asleep, when the defendant came in the room, whether they could remember their ages precisely. There was very little. And what they had was certainly not material to the charges, and materiality has to be considered in terms of this as well. Simply because they may have said at one point that they thought they might have been 8.5 versus 9 or 9, when the clear testimony and the statements made by the girls was that there were a lot of memory issues.
How would you articulate the rule that you're advocating if we assume sometime someone could get these examined in camera? What would they have to say?
In cases where there's an allegation of recantation, for example, they have another witness who says, I believe that they recanted. In that case, I think it would clearly.
Recanted to their therapist?
Yes, or that there was some indication they recanted somewhere else. Then you have a basis for believing that maybe there should, if they recanted over there, maybe they did here. That would be a clear case in the state's view where it would be appropriate to to invade the privilege. That would be critical to it.
You keep talking about invading the privilege. Is it your position that an in-camera inspection conducted by a superior court judge is an invasion of the privilege?
Yes, absolutely. When victims of sexual abuse seek counseling to get past that in their lives, there are many intimate things that are spoken of in counseling, and to have that exposed to anyone, be it a judge or and certainly to the accuser ultimately, which would be the next step if the court found anything, it is certainly an invasion of privacy, and it would have a chilling effect on having these children go to therapy, which is they're precisely the people who need to have counseling. As certainly it would be an invasion to have the court look. Not only that, it's highly, although the request is specific, in order for the court to find those inconsistent statements, the court would have to review the entire record of notes of the therapist. It's not just, oh, well, I can just look at this line here. That's a burdensome situation for the court as well in a practical sense. But there certainly are times when there's allegations that there's a medical condition, that the witness may have been taking medications that would affect their ability to recall or ability to relate. Those would all be cases where it would be appropriate, but I think it does have to be balanced. I think the appropriate test has been used by the Superior Court, and that it is fact-specific to each case. And in this case, they didn't.
What's your view on the standard of review on this issue? Is it abuse of discretion, or is it de novo review of a Sixth Amendment right?
Abuse of discretion. The judge used the correct standard. And in Ritchie v. Pennsylvania, the court, in fact, said there was no confrontation issue, that it was, in fact, a due process violation, not a confrontation clause issue. You're not guaranteed the most productive confrontation of a witness. Privileges are there in place for a reason. And the only reason that they even invaded there was because of the limited privilege, and the court declined to even voice an opinion on an absolute privilege.
The test that the Superior Court has used, is that consistent with federal case law?
Yes, it is.
And so there are circuit courts that have adopted those?
The only cases that the state could find were all related to, in some way or another, competency of witnesses in terms of whether they were under, for example, if they were under psychiatric care at the time of the incidents or at the time of testimony, situations like that.
So they're none on point?
Not precisely on point to this case that the state found. Will not represent they're not there in some fashion. I see I'm running out of time. Would the court like me to address the third issue?
Your choice.
Just I will point out that this court has recently ruled under Waterman and Flannery that the preferred default rule is that recorded statements do not go back to the jury, and that was appropriate in this case.
Thank you.
Just a couple of points regarding the buttressing of the outburst throughout the trial. Following the outburst, a trooper also testified on behalf of the state and referenced his encounter at the time that he interviewed the father. And an officer is supposed to be a neutral, he's trained to be a neutral fact finder. And what essentially he testified to was that he could not handle this case, and therefore he gave it to somebody else. And I think what is telling in that is that he's vouching for the credibility because he is essentially adopting what the complainants had told the father. And all of this goes to the emotional effect at the trial, which the prosecutor also referenced in her closing. The trooper, she mentioned how, you know, these are things that adults can't handle. It was the buttressing. It was not just the outburst. If the court looks at the outburst in a vacuum, it is on its face harmful. But what the state did to bring it back to the jury's attention is also prejudicial. And also, Justice Ridgely pointed out what should be the consequence here. And I think something that is worth noting is that a mistrial is put in place for this exact reason. It's put in place so that witnesses don't go unpunished for self-interested events that just occurred here. If a mistrial, it has to act as a deterrence. And that's exactly what the consequence should be here. I see my time is just about up.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.